This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today marks 150 years since North Carolina seceded from the Union. South Carolina had seceded 6 months earlier. The first shots had been fired on Fort Sumter in April. North Carolina was among the last of southern states to join the Confederacy. Historians have long taught that the state's relatively loose attachment to the institution of slavery was the reason why. Modern historians say that understanding is both true and incomplete. Today, we consider the forces that compelled North Carolina into the Civil War. Joining me by phone are Judkin Browning, Assistant Professor of Civil War and Military History at Appalachian State University, and Harry Watson is Director of the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Judkin, Harry, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So Lincoln was elected in 1860. That's all it took for South Carolina to secede, but it took more than that for North Carolinians to get behind secession. Harry, let's start by taking a look at the course of events that led to the vote of delegates that finally ended in secession.
Well, sure. North and South Carolina had diverged in politics long before 1860, way back in the 1830s. Two states were kind of headed in different directions, South Carolina being much more militant about the defense of slavery, and North Carolina much more attached to national standards, national parties, national political causes, and so on. And the South Carolina way of thinking gradually spread through the Deep South, but not as much in this direction as it did Georgia's, Alabama, Mississippi, and so on. And therefore, the Deep South was very, very sensitive to any challenge to slavery, and when an anti-slavery president was elected in 1860, South Carolina thought that was intolerable, that they could not wait to see whether he was going to do all the things they were afraid he might do, and decided that they had to pull out, and six other Deep South states followed them. But the dominant position in North Carolina was watch and wait, and the state in February had an election about whether to hold a secession convention, and at the same time they elected delegates to that convention if the convention was ever held. And they narrowly defeated the idea of having a convention at all, but the delegates that they elected, the biggest number were unconditional unionists, and then there was a smaller number of secessionists, and a swing group in the middle called conditional unionists. That is, they were willing to stay in the Union if certain conditions were met. So the unionists and the conditional unionists were the vast majority in February, but one of the conditions of the conditional unionists was that the Lincoln government do nothing to coerce the seceding states back into the Union, and another condition was that it do nothing to harm slavery. Well, when the Confederacy fired on Fort Sumter and Lincoln called for troops, that was a open declaration that the Union was going to use coercion to bring back the seceding states, and that violated condition number one. And the very idea of invading the South with federal troops made a lot of people feel like slavery would be endangered by that very action. So that violated condition number two, and therefore white North Carolinians seemed to flip, the majority of them, to be in favor of secession almost overnight when the news from Fort Sumter and from Washington reached the state.
Judkin, how did North Carolina compare to other southern states in terms of slave ownership?
Well, certainly North Carolina as an upper South state in general, the upper South being the states of North Carolina and Virginia, Kentucky, Arkansas, they had fewer slaves than the Deep South states. So there's no denying that. And the relative slave ownership in the state of North Carolina, I mean, the percentage of the white population who owned slaves was not very high and certainly lower than a lot of the Deep South states. I mean, so there's certainly a lot into that idea that, you know, North Carolina was reluctant to secede because of less of an attachment to slavery, as Dr. Watson had said, in the Deep South.
But, Harry, now it wasn't solely the number of slaves. It was also about how white people felt about slavery itself. There had been, by this time, a kind of intellectual and religious architecture that had built in. The idea of white supremacy became part of the Southern and North Carolina's identity as well?
Sure. First of all, let's remember that the North Carolina population was about one-third enslaved. So that's a lot of people. It's less than South Carolina, where a majority of the population were slaves. So to that extent, North Carolina is less attached than South Carolina, but it's a lot more attached than, say, Maryland. And that will have a difference later on. As far as the justifications for slavery are concerned, the Southerners had been putting forth those justifications for as long as some people had been criticizing slavery. And at the time of the American Revolution, there were a lot of people who said, especially in the states where slavery was very rare, that this institution violates our ideals of liberty and equality and so on. And those states, starting with Massachusetts, ended the institution. Later on, people began to denounce the states that did not end slavery for immorality and for excessive political domination of the nation and one thing and another. And as they made their case louder and louder, white Southerners began to respond by defending the institution. They could defend it by citing the Bible. They could defend it by citing theories of race, saying that Africans were by nature inferior to white people, and therefore the only place for them in the world was as servants. But eventually, the most sophisticated defenders of slavery said that slavery made the South a better place than the Union or the Northern United States, and that the South was really a better country, freer for white people than the North was. The rationalization was that there always has to be what they call a mud sill, that is a bottom layer underneath the foundation that in society as well as in a house that does all the dirty work. And the South has found a race that is suited by nature to do all this dirty work. They're fit for nothing else. But in the North, white people have to do that dirty work, and they are degraded, and they don't enjoy the equality with wealthier whites that they ought to have. And therefore, the North is a more unequal society and a less free society, a less democratic society. Whereas the South, whites enjoy the equality that they ought to have, and that makes us better than them.
So then this construction of white identity around white supremacy is why some non-slaveholders would support the Confederacy. So, Judkin, who were the slaveholders in North Carolina?
How do you mean?
Well, where were they located in general? Yeah.
Well, the strongest contingent or the strongest number of slaveholders were primarily in the eastern coastal plain and the Piedmont, particularly the southern Piedmont area around Mecklenburg County along the border of South Carolina and then moving eastward. But then that also sort of belies a myth to the state, which was that the slaveholding was really only concentrated in certain areas of the state, and therefore other areas of the state were less interested. And that's not really true. I mean, there was slaveholding in every county of the state of North Carolina to varying degrees, and as a result, there were both people who were in favor of the Confederacy and then people who were opposed to the Confederacy in favor of the Union spread out throughout the entire state as well. So it wasn't a monolithic state, and when you think of the state of North Carolina, we grow up in school sort of learning, you know, you have the West, you have the Piedmont, you have the East, and in the West, they were all Unionists, and in the East, they were all secessionists. And the fact of the matter is that neither of those are really true, that there were plenty of Unionists and secessionists sprinkled throughout all three regions.
How do you suppose that idea got started, the idea that the West was a haven of Unionists and resisted entry into the war?
Part of it is certainly the fact of the matter that during the war itself, the West served as a hideout, a refuge for a lot of people either dodging conscription or a lot of people who desert, make their way to the mountains simply because of the nature of the terrain. It's harder to be found in the mountains. And so you have that as part of it. And I also believe that there was this general sense in Appalachia in general, not just the state of North Carolina, but the Appalachian region, that the early writers of Appalachian history, the color writers, as they referred to themselves or as they were referred to, tended to build this or entrench this myth that the Appalachian region was sort of a unionist enclave and united against the Confederacy. And it's just taken a long time for historians to sort of chip away at that myth and to do a lot of digging and research and realize that there were an awful lot of Unionists in the Piedmont and in the eastern coastal plain, and there were also an awful lot of pro-Confederates in the western part of the state.
And you have, your most recent book examined two eastern counties, and you found some profound divisions in the east. Tell us about the study.
Well, so my recent book, Shifting Loyalties, focuses on eastern North Carolina, particularly Carteret and Craven County. Carteret with Beaufort as the county seat, and Craven County with Newbern as the county seat. And those two counties are adjacent to each other, and they're both accessible to the ocean. They're right on the sea. They're at the southern tip of the Outer Banks. But there's a large difference between them. Craven County, both counties were very strong Unionist counties throughout much of the antebellum period until around 1859 with the John Brown raid at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, in October of 59. And at that point, Craven County starts to undergo a shift, and they become much more wary of a potential, much more sympathetic to a potential secession, much more wary of a potential another John Brown being in their midst. And so when Lincoln is elected in November of 1860, Craven County is fairly strongly in favor of seceding at that point, and they form part of the group of North Carolinians who are in favor of secession now. While Carteret County, which was their neighbor and right on the coast, was opposed to it. They were against secession now, and as a matter of fact, they were only reluctantly dragged into secession after Fort Sumter, after Lincoln called for troops. And it's a sort of remarkable fact that, you know, here we have these two counties right beside each other. Their livelihoods are similar in a lot of ways, yet they take sort of different tracks, different stances in terms of whether or not we should secede.
Harry Watson, this suggests that the question of, if not secession, slavery and, how to protect the institution, how far we would go, might have played an important role in North Carolina politics in the decade or so preceding the Civil War, did it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The state had a very strong political party system that had taken shape around issues of economic development. Should the state pay for railroads? Should the government sponsor a bank? This kind of thing. So it wasn't directly caused by slavery, although there were certain linkages there. But the way it shook out was that the largest slaveholding counties were the least in favor of government expenses for that kind of thing. By and large, every once in a while you'll find an exception, but if you add up the number on one side and the number on the other, you'll find that having a large concentration of slaves tended to predispose you to the party of, if you will, small government, and the counties with fewer slaves, and there were more of them in the West than there were in the East, but there were some in the East also, were more likely to be in favor of this kind of economic development. So as time passed, the states' rights defense of slavery became stronger and stronger in the Democratic Party, and the Whigs kind of resisted it. And while the National Whig Party eventually fell apart because its pro-slavery and anti-slavery wings couldn't agree, North Carolina continued to have this division of opinion between people who still thought of themselves as Whigs and people who thought of themselves as Democrats, so that the emergence of a Southern Rights Party was very closely linked to the Democrats, and the emergence of a kind of Unionist cause was very much connected with the old line Whigs.
Now, once the first blood was shed and North Carolina had entered the war, did the debate end or did it continue?
It did not end entirely. I think the first year or so of the war, there was more unity in the state government. What actually happened was that the state turned to the Whigs for leadership after 1862, or the ex-Whigs, sort of trusting them not to be as perhaps as hot-headed or as reckless as some of the Southern rights people had been that got us into the war in the first place. But people like Governor Vance, who had been a Whig, were very strong supporters of North Carolina staying in the war, even though they criticized the Confederate government very bitterly. But eventually, by 1864, there was so much dissatisfaction and disaffection in the state that a former secessionist, William W. Holden, who was just pardoned for his role in Reconstruction, actually, came out in favor of seeking peace more aggressively. And he never said so directly, but the implication was that he wanted to secede from the Confederacy and make a separate peace with the Union. And that was the issue on which the 1864 gubernatorial election was fought, and the peace candidate got only about a quarter of the votes, so it wasn't, so it was a landslide in favor of the pro-war candidate, Governor Vance. But nevertheless, it indicated a deep division inside the state. It was certainly not a unanimous white population
right,
going all the way to the bitter end.
Judkin Browning, you talked about the divisions in those eastern counties, Carteret and Craven. They were also occupied very quickly by Union troops at the beginning of the Civil War.
Right.
What was the impact of the political divisions in those two counties once those counties were occupied?
Well, in terms of North Carolina state politics, it wasn't an awful lot since they were cut off from the state of North Carolina altogether. But what happens in these two counties once the Union soldiers arrive, and you're right, they do arrive early in March of 1862, and they remain for the rest of the war. What happens is then in Craven County, or at least in the city of New Bern in Craven County, those whites who can get out, they flee as the Union army is approaching. There was the Battle of New Bern in March of 1862. The people in Beaufort are pretty much locked in. The Carteret County people are cut off, and most of them remain during the war. And what happens is the people, the white people in the region, more or less accept Union occupation, make peace with it to a certain extent. That lasts for about a six-month period, maybe 9 months if you want to be really generous. And then when it becomes apparent that what the Union forces are bringing is a lot more social change than the people of Carteret and Craven are willing to accept, then resistance to the occupation starts manifesting itself. In a lot of ways, it sort of shows, one of the things that I argue is that Carteret County, which was not a very large slaveholding county, only about 25% of the population was slaves, but the attitudes of the local whites in this region to occupation, particularly to the racial policies of occupation, show that white supremacy was still very much a core belief of that society. And so even though the majority of the people were not owning slaves, they definitely believed that it should be a white man's government. And the fact that the Union is not going to any longer be the Union of 1860, that's the one that they were wanting to go back to, but it was going to be a new Union with these new policies, particularly ones that granted freedom and a certain amount of equality to African Americans, then that was going to be too much for them to take, and resistance stiffened to the occupation as a result.
Judkin, Harry, thank you both for being on the program. Happy to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Harry Watson's a professor and director of the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill. Judkin Browning is an assistant professor of Civil War history at Appalachian State University. You can listen in May for more reflections on the Civil War and its aftermath when WUNC airs its series, North Carolina Voices. Next up, Fan Modine plays live on the State of Things. Please stay tuned.